All rise.
Be seated, please. The court is ready to hear argument in 061018 D.R. Horton, Texas Limited versus Markel International Insurance Company Limited.
May it please the court, Mr. Gilbreth and Mr. Evans will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Gilbreth will open with the first 15 minutes. Mr. Evans will present the rebuttal.
May it please the court. When this court issued its opinion in Guide 1, it appeared to be on the verge of recognizing a limited exception to the complaint allegation or eight corners rule, which is used for determining whether an insurance company owes a duty to defend its insured. And that was a breakthrough for a couple of reasons. First, the lower courts in Texas had been reaching inconsistent conclusions about when extrinsic evidence may be considered in order to determine whether there's a duty to defend. And second, there was a great need for at least a limited exception to the eight corners rule, which would benefit both policyholders and insurers alike. But earlier this year, when the court issued its opinion in the Pine Oak case, it seemed to retreat back to a rather rigid approach to the eight corners rule. And on its face, Pine Oak might seem to preclude any argument that the lower courts erred in refusing to give effect to the extrinsic evidence that my client proffered in this case in order to show that Markel Insurance Company owed a duty to defend.
Well, why would this be a fact situation where we can go perhaps where Guide 1 suggested the court should go in these type of facts?
Why would this be the type of fact situation? Well, for a couple of reasons, Your Honor. One, the most important, I think, to consider here is that in Pine Oak, when the court rejected the use of extrinsic evidence, it did so to prevent the named insured from showing that an exclusion in the policy did not apply. You remember there, the insured was a home builder and it wanted to show that it used subcontractors, because if it did, then it would be able to avoid exclusion L in the policy and show that it didn't apply.
Well, so here you have a subcontractor as well, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. But what we're trying to do, what Pine Oak did not involve the threshold question of whether the party seeking insurance coverage qualifies as an insured in the first instance. And that's what this case is about. Here, D.R. Horton wants to show that it used a particular subcontractor to build the house in question, not to avoid the application of an exclusion, but rather to show, to establish its status as an additional insured under its subcontractor's liability insurance policy. And that's an important distinction.
Was Ramirez, I think the builder, was he named as an additional insured, or is it an additional insured because of the work performed?
Ramirez had the policy that D.R. Horton was named as an additional insured under for certain purposes. We were an additional insured. We had to show that the work that the plaintiffs were complaining about on the house arose out of something that Ramirez did. But it's a very important distinction in this case from Pine Oak, because courts and commentators have long recognized that extrinsic evidence should always be admissible to determine whether a person is a complete stranger to the policy or an insured. And let me give an example. Let's assume that a plaintiff sues me alleging that as a Baker Botts attorney I committed malpractice. And then let's assume further the truth. I'm not a Baker Botts attorney. So should Baker Botts liability insurer be required to defend me, a complete stranger to the policy, based on allegations made by another complete stranger to the policy? Well, most courts and comments.
Don't most policies say we're going to defend you? Now, and we're talking about indemnity here. Understand that, but most policies say we're going to defend you, whether they're true, false, fraudulent, or whatever. The policies themselves cover those situations, do they not?
They do,
on
but
the defense.
But that goes to the allegations, the liability facts that are alleged in the petition. The policy, before you get to that point, the policy says you first have to have an insured. And so that's why courts and commentators have said, look, when it comes to the question of whether you're an insured in the first instance, then extrinsic evidence is admissible.
What if,
sorry, go ahead. How's that different from Guide 1?
Guide 1 is different because in Guide 1, the attempt to use extrinsic evidence was to show whether the person seeking additional insured status was working for the church at the time of the alleged events. And I don't think that the issue there was whether in fact they were an insured. But also another distinction with Guide 1 is that our evidence doesn't overlap with liability issues, which I will address. But I wanted to make the point and emphasize this point because I urge the court to address this head on, this question of whether you can use extrinsic evidence to show that somebody is an insured in the first instance, because it's an issue that will keep coming up before the court. I think Mr. Taylor, Ben Taylor, is still out in the audience, and he has a case before the court right now, the Erickson case, in which, as a respondent on behalf of an insurance company, he's arguing to the court you ought to consider extrinsic evidence on this narrow question of whether a person has insured status, whether they're an insured.
I'd like to yield some of your time to Mr. Taylor. He is indeed out there.
But that can be not so straightforward a question. And, I mean, the purpose of the eight-corner rule is just so that the insurer can look at the complaint, look at the policy, and make that determination.
I think so, but it's more often the insurance companies, just as in Mr. Taylor's case, where they want to say, this guy's a stranger to the policy, and he's not an insured, so we don't have any obligation to defend until you are determined to be an insured. So the whole question of the eight corners rule, it goes to the duty to defend and the allegations in the petition, but you don't get there until you figure out, well, is this person an insured or
not? We can agree that D.R. Horton is an insured. It's an additional insured. The question is, when you read the petition, are they named? Is it the conduct of Ramirez, the subcontractor, that's at issue, or is it D.R. Horton? And that is determined by the eight corners of the petition plus the policy.
Well, the petition is silent on that point, and it doesn't contradict the petition for us to say, because we all know, I can't think of maybe there's a solo home builder out there, but for the rest of the home builders in the world, everybody knows they use subcontractors. So when the petition is silent and says D.R. Horton built this house, all we want to say is, yes, we built the house, but like every other home builder, we use subcontractors to do it. And we used Ramirez, and that one fact triggers additional insured coverage for us.
Why wouldn't that just come out in the course of discovery, and then there will be a supplemental request for coverage? And you could amend the pleadings to correct that, or I guess the plaintiff's lawyer in this case could amend the pleadings so that they can plead into coverage as opposed to pleading out of coverage?
That could happen, yes, Your Honor.
That'd be simpler?
That could happen. But at this point, for the court to say, because what the court said, the lower court said, well, there's just flat no duty to defend, because if it's not in the petition, then there's no duty to defend. And even if it came out during discovery, there's no guarantee that the plaintiff is going to amend. And I don't think we want to encourage, you know, collusion between a defendant and a plaintiff where the defendant says, hey, you need to amend.
Well,
the petition.
It wouldn't be collusion. Either the facts exist that there's an additional insured, or they don't. It wouldn't be no collusion at all.
But I think it
seems to me that would be the simplest way to handle it.
I think so too, Your Honor. But the way the eight corners rule has been developing, at least in Pine Oak, is it's got to be in the petition. So if it's in the discovery, it's not going to trigger the duty to defend.
And but doesn't that go to the duty to defend? And aren't we here on indemnity?
Well, we have two issues before the court, Your Honor. We have both duty to defend and duty to indemnify. Now, the court's opinion in Pine Oak might seem to preclude our arguments on duty to defend, but that's why I'm pleading with the court to reconsider that in this situation, this limited situation where the question is not whether an exclusion to coverage applies, but rather whether we have insured status to begin with.
Well, but again, that's not so simple a question. You know, whether somebody's insured, it may depend upon whether an employee was acting in the course and scope. So although it may sound easy, I can envision many, if not most, circumstances where it would not be.
It may be true, Your Honor, and it may need to be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. But I think in a case like this one, where it's a simple fact of did we use Ramirez or not, or, you know, it's a question that you get to before the eight corners rule kicks in. And and it's going to keep coming up before this court, so I would urge the court to take it on in this case, because if you just say Pine Oak controls, they lose on duty to defend, and you haven't addressed this question of, well, what about the issue of insured status?
In reverse, what if there's an allegation that appears to trigger the duty to defend when indeed the allegation is not correct, so that the insurer could rely on additional evidence to exclude coverage?
I think it does work both ways. The rule that we're proposing is impact neutral. Both insurance companies and policyholders could use it. So if it goes not to exclusions, nothing like that, but just to the question of, is this person an insured, then yes, the insurance company, like that Baker Botts example I gave, insurance company could come in and say, wait a minute, Gilbreth's not an attorney with Baker Botts. He's a complete stranger to this policy. We owe no duty to defend.
In the home suit, if D.R. Horton had brought the Ramirez's in as third-party defendants for contribution or something, would that have addressed your concern?
I don't know,
they'd
Your Honor.
They'd be in the pleadings in the case, maybe not the plaintiff's pleadings.
I don't know the answer to that question, because I don't think we have any case law that says whether you can consider a third-party complaint under the Eight Corners rule. And so I would, I mean, as the Eight Corners, under the strictest view of the Eight Corners rule, which we seem to be adhering to these days, that the answer would be no. It's the plaintiff's petition and the insurance policy that control. You can't look to a third-party complaint. It doesn't make sense to me. I think you would. Should be able to look at some other complaint like that. But let me also say
that's an open question. We haven't said you can't.
That's right.
We haven't said you can.
That's right. But why would we want to encourage people like D.R. Horton to bring in the subcontractor when it would do us no good? Because we could not avoid liability on the basis of an independent contractor defense. So bringing him in would be an exercise in futility. The only purpose would be to try to get us insurance coverage. So we wouldn't want to encourage that, I would think.
Could we talk about the indemnity question?
Yep.
Here for a little while?
Yes,
we're talking
Your Honor.
About the duty to defend, and and you settled the case, and you settled, and there's no question that your sub actually did some or all of the work, as I understand on the summary judgment evidence. I mean, but yet you've been denied indemnity. Was there ever a request for indemnity, or was there any information exchanged between the D.R. Horton and the carriers about the indemnity question?
Yes, Your Honor, I think there was. After the suit was settled, we said you need to indemnify us.
About before the suit was settled?
Well, it wasn't. It probably the issue of indemnification wouldn't be right, but let me do say this, Your Honor. About 16 days after suit was filed, we sent a letter to Markel Insurance Company saying, look, Ramirez did this work, and you ought to defend us. And I can't remember if the letter said indemnify us as well. It probably did, although indemnification doesn't come up until there's been a settlement.
It's kind of important if you're demanding, if they're going to deny whether you demanded indemnity or defense, it would seem.
Oh, well, sure, but
is that letter in the record?
The letter is in the record, Your Honor. I don't happen to have the page number, but I can get it to the court. But it's there. So we did tell them, you know, Ramirez was involved. We told them 16 days after suit was filed. They had plenty of time to file a declaratory judgment action or whatever they wanted to do.
Did you? Is there anything in the record about whether while you were negotiating for settlement, you told the company, look, you didn't defend us, but you still have an indemnity obligation out there, and we're negotiating to get rid of this case. Do you want to come participate, or do you want us to sue you later? Was there any of that conversation?
I'm not aware of that being in the record. I would suspect that that was going on between the carrier and the D.R. Horton's attorneys, but I can't say for sure, Your Honor.
What does legally obligated to pay mean?
Legally obligated to pay refers to, actually, it's an interesting question. I mean, it would refer to a judgment, a settlement. And I think
that's the question. Does it apply to a settlement?
Yes, Your Honor. And I can't cite you case and verse on that right now, but that
was... Because we don't allow a settling party to get contribution. Is that right? Why should we allow a settling party to get indemnity, regardless of the policy?
Well, because I think that my recollection of the way the law is developed is that the insurance company always has the right to challenge the settlement as unreasonable, but it's always been the duty of an insurance company to pay a settlement or a judgment. They do have the opportunity to say, well, we think this settlement was unreasonable and we shouldn't have to
pay. But under the terms of this policy, it does say that the insured becomes legally obligated to pay, and that would seem to imply a legal finding of liability.
Well, I think it's broader than that. I think that it should cover the duty, I mean, a settlement. But
you can't get to that step unless it's been determined that there's coverage and that there's a duty to defend first, right?
No, not on duty to indemnify, because there's no, that's the problem. That's what happened in this case.
Well, you can't say we don't have a duty to defend, but we're going to go ahead and settle the case. That makes no sense.
If there's no duty, even if there's no duty to defend, there's still a duty to indemnify, because the duty to indemnify is based on the actual facts of
but
the
let's,
case.
Let's look at, how would, let's say there's no settlement. How would D.R. Horton establish that it was Ramirez's work that was responsible for this?
If there was no settlement.
So it goes to a jury. How does D.R. Horton, and you haven't sued for contribution, the subcontractor? You haven't brought them in as a responsible third party. How would you get a fact finding that would establish their work to be the underlying cause of this?
I think I can think of a couple of ways. Let me the first way probably is not the answer you're looking for, Your Honor. But just let me say that it probably would have come out in this case, because D.R. Horton probably would have defended on the grounds that, hey, the chimney was properly built; it wasn't defective. And so in order to show that, we'd have Ramirez testify. Here's how I built the chimney. I did it in a good and workmanlike manner. So that would have come out perhaps in the underlying case. If not, then there is an opinion by Judge Sidney Fitzwater called in the Swicegood case, where he addresses, makes an eerie guess at Texas law, and he says, I think that under Texas law, you would be able to bring in facts that were not developed in the underlying case to show that there was a duty to indemnify. And so the Swicegood case is cited and quoted in our brief, and there's a more recent Fifth Circuit case that would support that proposition. It's the ResCare case, and I think the citation, I'll just give to the court real quick. It is 529 Fed Third 649. It's not directly on point, but it does support the proposition that you would be able to bring in evidence that wasn't developed in the underlying case on this duty to indemnify question.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counselor. Court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Pickett will present argument for the respondent.
Court. Your Honors, if I seem nervous, I am. I apologize for my first time to appear before this court. I do wish to point out a couple of things that I think are outcome determinative. These lawyers appeared on behalf of Horton in a motion for rehearing at the Court of Appeals. That was the first time that there was any briefing asking for a limited exception to the Eight Corners Rule. Indeed, at the trial court and at the Court of Appeals, Horton had said, the Eight Corners Rule guides this court's determination on the duty to defend. And the second issue, which they've never once acknowledged in their briefing, is that the trial court overruled all of my objections to their summary judgment evidence. Not only did we object that it was extrinsic evidence and couldn't be considered in the duty to defend, but we objected that it was replete with hearsay, that there were incomplete contracts, there were contradictory statements in the evidence that they submitted. But nonetheless, the court found that there was no scintilla, there was no proof, there was no fact question that Rosendo Ramirez did the work that caused the mold propagation, which is...
We all know that mold's not covered, thanks to Justice Brister in the Feist case. But here, what would be so wrong if this additional extrinsic evidence is applicable to both sides, to either deny coverage or to show that there is a duty, I'm sorry, deny the duty to defend or establish that there's a duty to defend at the onset before a lot of money is expended by both parties to try to get issues resolved?
I believe that this court and other courts has already recognized a limited coverage facts only extrinsic evidence exception. The evidence that they wanted to present here is directly the same evidence in the Glass petition from Pine Oaks. The Holmes, the underlying plaintiffs here, pleaded that D.R. Horton and only D.R. Horton designed and built this house. The evidence that they wanted to introduce said, no, a subcontractor did this. And so that the record's clear here, it wasn't just the chimney that the Holmes complained about. They complained about windows and window framing and vent pipes, and I don't know that they may have filed a lawsuit against those other subcontractors' insurers as well. And that's the problem. Their extrinsic evidence they wanted to introduce is not coverage facts only. It challenged the actual factual allegations. I have in my office a case that is a coverage facts only. The insured supplied doors and windows on a construction job, and the insurance company, and it along with other contractors, was sued for defective construction. I'm asked to analyze coverage. The petition has no dates. It doesn't say when the construction took place or when the damages occurred. We asked the insured, give us your invoice to show when you sold these doors, and lo and behold, it was after our policy expired. I think that's the type of extrinsic evidence that doesn't challenge the allegations in the lawsuit. It only provides a date when they did the work. That's the type of limited exception I would say this court could find. But the facts of this case are horrible. This is not the case to issue that. The underlying case, they apparently sent a letter to somebody that they thought was an agent for Markel, this letter that went out 16 days after the underlying case was filed, but it did not go to our agent identified in the policy. There are no facts that were developed to address the indemnity issue. There are no facts that were developed in the underlying case that connected Rosendo Ramirez to any work on this house.
If there were those facts, would you agree there'd be a duty to indemnify, even if there wasn't, to defend under the original petition?
No, Your Honor, because, and I addressed that in our motion for summary judgment at the trial court level. We said, even if they could somehow show that there was that the additional insured endorsement was triggered, there are several exclusions to the claims that the Holmes pleaded. We had a total pollution exclusion endorsement, molds, a contaminant, and we asserted that the Holmes case was based upon mold, and so therefore that it would not be covered.
If there were no exclusions, is there a scenario where there could be no duty to defend initially, but because of the way facts were developed or established at trial, there is a duty to indemnify because additional insured status was triggered?
There could be. I can't think of one right now, Your Honor.
How about a settlement?
That's the real problem, is that because all the cases that I've read that talk about the duty to indemnify, they all say it's based upon the facts determined during the litigation of the underlying case. And in this case, they did not develop any facts.
Yeah, does the policy say that you'll only indemnify based upon the facts developed in the underlying case? Or does it say you'll indemnify if you have liability for certain matters that are covered within the policy? What does your policy say about indemnity?
The policy says it has the standard CGL language. We will pay those sums that the insurer becomes legally obligated to pay.
Okay, so it doesn't restrict it to simply the underlying case development.
No,
it says. So if they sue you on the policy and say, look, we settled this case over here, the allegations were we built this chimney wrong. Let's just assume those are the allegations. But the facts are, as you know from your insured, and we're going to sue you and prove your insured built that chimney, so we're an additional insured. If you don't step up to the plate now and do something on the settlement, we're going to sue you for that. Now, wouldn't your policy liability depend on what's proved up in that suit, independent of what went on in the original case?
If all of those facts were true.
Okay, so your liability depends on what's in your policy, not what happened in the original case.
No, it's all tied together. Our policy is a contract, and we are obligated to do what our contract
right.
says. But it also depends on what facts are developed. And as this court and other courts have held, it's the facts developed in the underlying case that determine whether or not we have a duty to indemnify.
But how does that make any sense? The plaintiff wants to settle. The defendant says, okay, we want to settle. But first, we've got to put on a big bunch of evidence about how come somebody else really did this. The plaintiff doesn't care. We just want to get through. The trial court certainly doesn't want to hear it if everybody's settled. But if we don't put it on, we can't get indemnity.
I don't know that they couldn't develop facts in a coverage case. But under the facts of this case, they didn't do that. They had that opportunity. In our summary judgment.
I was trying to make sure I understood that you think they can develop the facts leading to indemnification in the coverage case, not in the underlying case?
I don't know the answer to that. I haven't read a case that says you can do that. I've read their brief where they suggest that there's a decision from another, I think he said,
it seems as though if we go that way, though, if we don't allow that, then what's going to happen, it would seem logical, is that D.R. Horton is going to join the liability carrier in the primary suit. So you'll be bound by those facts. Otherwise, they won't ever get to prove up. It seems like you end up with the liability carrier as a named party in the primary suit, and that's not probably what the liability carriers generally wanted, as I recall.
Your Honor, typically the way I handle those cases when I defend a case that has facts similar to Horton, I would sue my subcontractor, not just DR, not just Ramirez.
Who would sue the subcontractor?
DR Horton.
Okay.
I would sue, and in this case, it wasn't just the chimney that they complained about. Again, it was the windows and the framing, the vent. I would sue all of those subcontractors.
Right.
If my position as DR Horton's counsel is that I have a contract with a subcontractor, and I think that the damages I'm being sued about were caused by your work. I understand their argument about the RCRA issue. RCRA only says that a contractor can't avoid liability for the negligence of its subcontractors. It does not prohibit the homeowner from suing those subcontractors. In the reality, in the practical effect, you as the contractor or a home builder, you sue all of your subs. You bring them in.
But they didn't want to in this case, apparently, and that's their choice.
But they may not think they need to if they are named expressly as an additional insured, right?
Right. But
let me back up and ask on a conceptual level to see exactly where you stand, I hope. You believe the eight corners rule determines the duty to defend?
Correct.
Beyond that, when you're talking about indemnity, there are scenarios where the eight corners rule does not limit indemnity. In other words, additional facts that are developed can provide for indemnity outside of the boundaries of the eight corners rule.
If I imagine factual scenarios, yes, I believe that could happen.
Mm-hmm. And but what's this? And so you believe that those exceptions are, or those other circumstances are very narrowly defined, it sounds like, if I can read from what you're saying and your gesture.
That's going to have to be on a case-by-case basis. That's why I keep trying, and I'm not artfully saying it very well, but the facts of this case, we litigated in the trial court. If the Court of Appeals decision on the indemnity was not as well reasoned or well written as an opinion from this court would be, or as some of the commentators have complained about it, what they failed to grasp is that the trial court had before it all of that evidence on the indemnity issue. And the court overruled all my objections and still said, your evidence doesn't create a fact question. I don't know what the basis of the trial court's grant of summary judgment to me was, because it doesn't say. It just says you win.
Yeah, and that's true, but the Court of Appeals said, looking at our opinions, looking at what we said in Pine Oak and Guide 1, that you can't even look at that extrinsic evidence, notwithstanding what the trial court may or may not have done. And the Court of Appeals relied primarily on the Resser case, which purported to cite Griffin and say that you can't look at these extrinsic facts. I agree with the Court of Appeals that Resser says that. I don't agree with Resser that Griffin is that restrictive, however. Griffin was the drive-by shooting case that said, there are no set of facts that can turn a drive-by shooting into an auto accident. I think that may be misinterpreted by some of our courts of appeals as saying you can't look at extrinsic evidence. There we're just saying a drive-by shooting can't be an auto accident under any set of circumstances.
Right.
So I think Griffin may be being mischaracterized.
And that's why I said it may be that the Court of Appeals analysis and writing on the indemnity issue may not be as well done as it would be from this court. But the conclusion is correct. The fact was, the pleadings in the underlying case said Horton and only Horton negligently built this house and built and designed the house. Proof of those facts in that pleading would not trigger any coverage under this policy. That's the way I interpret what the Court of Appeals did. But they what I think the Court of Appeals did is they stopped after they realized that under the extrinsic evidence rule, there would be no duty to defend.
Let me stop you if I may, counsel. I apologize. From what you just said, it sounds like you're limiting indemnity to the eight corners of the petition and the policy, though. And I thought you'd agreed that indemnity depends on the facts proven.
And I agree with you.
Developed, whatever those terms may end up meaning.
I agree with you. I think the Court of Appeals analysis on that issue may be flawed, but their conclusion is correct because the trial court, we litigated the duty to indemnify in the underlying case. Horton produced evidence that was not part of the record from the Holmes litigation. They created affidavits in our case. In fact, one was like a 7-page affidavit from their lawyer going on and extolling how Resendez Ramirez did this work, and it was his opinion that there was coverage. Okay, but my point is that we litigated. We had the facts. They had an opportunity to present their facts to prove a duty to indemnify under our policy.
So your position would be then, as far as what we should do, is we address the Eight Corners rule on duty to defend and whether we should allow extrinsic evidence, and then separately look at your trial court record to see if you were entitled to summary judgment on the duty to indemnify or if a fact question was raised on the duty to indemnify. So we look at it two separate ways when we address it in this case. Is that your position?
I believe the record supports the court's granting of summary judgment to me on the duty to indemnify as
right.
Well.
But you believe that it supports it both on duty to defend and separately on duty to indemnify.
Yes.
And that is the position you took in the trial court.
And in the Court of Appeals.
And that's the way, and the Court of Appeals combined those, and our analysis would be appropriate in your view if we looked at them separately and addressed them separately based upon the records.
Right. I think what the Court of Appeals did is once they determined under the extrinsic evidence rule there's no duty to defend, they stopped and said, well, we don't need to go any further on the duty to indemnify, whereas we had briefed to the Court of Appeals. I won on the duty to indemnify not only on that issue of the pleadings issue, but also because of the policy exclusions, a pollution exclusion and other insurance clause that said our policy was excess over other available insurance.
Justice O'Neill asked a while ago if a settlement is legal liability to pay. What's your view on that?
It's correct. If there is a settlement that they are legally obligated to pay because it is a contract, and if they are an insured under the policy, and if the claims that are addressed in that settlement are covered by the policy, then perhaps there's a duty to pay.
Yes, of course. The trial
just,
court.
I'm sorry. Just clarification for me. Having been involved in insurance on both sides for about 18 years, I was always taught that the duty to defend is much broader than the duty to indemnify, which seems to me to indicate that if you have no duty to defend, then you have no duty to indemnify. But I heard otherwise from Mr. Gilbreath that you could have no duty to defend, but a duty to indemnify. What's your response to that?
I was always taught and I always read the cases to say that if you've got no duty to defend, you should have no duty to indemnify. But what I've heard from the bench and from opposing counsel is that, say, for example, there are other facts that come out during the course of the trial which contradict the pleadings. It may be that could happen, but
in the course of discovery, if you learn other things that may trigger the duty to indemnify, then you go on to the trial. Okay.
But you seem to say that's unusual. That happens all the time, doesn't it? I mean, something doesn't fit the four corners rule, but then a question will come up under the evidence as to coverage. So I would see that as the norm as opposed to some aberration.
I would say that typically when you have your pleadings that set out the allegations of the case, if there are new facts developed during the course of the trial, there will be amended pleadings. So then the duty to defend could be addressed again later. Right. But, it's been my practice that all of the facts are known before you go to trial. It's very rare that some new fact pops up during trial.
But, counsel, that approach would then make the insurance coverage dependent upon an independent party's willingness to amend rather than dependent upon the terms of your policy with your insured. Are you comfortable placing your duty to cover or not cover in the hands of a third party unconnected to you who's suing you?
Well, in real life, that's the way it generally works. I mean, they're not going to plead out of coverage if there's an opportunity to have coverage. So.
That's what I'm stuck with on the eight corners.
I mean, the options are, at least a couple of the options, the extent of your coverage being dependent upon a party on the other side of the case from you. versus your coverage obligations being dependent upon the terms of your policy and the facts that are proven. You're saying that you're dependent upon the pleadings, and you may be saying you're comfortable with that.
Maybe I'm not understanding your question, but I can't control what pleadings there are. That the pleadings, the facts included in the pleadings, that determines the duty to defend.
Right, and we're talking about indemnity.
Right, and so I can't control what the facts of the case are. It's an old cliche, the facts are the facts. I don't make the facts. And so if the facts come out and show that there's something that might be covered under the policy, we have to address that separately from the duty to defend.
But as a practical matter, if facts come out that would indicate an indemnity obligation, doesn't the insurer then want to come in and voluntarily defend because they're defending their own indemnity obligation?
If those facts are created during the pendency of the underlying suit, certainly the insurance company would want to be involved. But typically what you'll find there is, for the reasons that they denied coverage originally, they're going to issue a reservation of rights letter, right, and the insurer is going to reject their attorneys.
Right. We talked about whether legally obligated to pay does or doesn't include a voluntary settlement, but assume it does. Am I wrong in remembering, isn't there a provision in the policy that says that unless the insurer signs off on the agreed settlement, there's no duty to pay up?
Correct, Your Honor. And that was part of our summary judgment. I argued in the trial court, not only do we not owe an obligation to indemnify because of the pleadings issue, but you violated the other consent to payment clause. Well, you made a voluntary payment under the policy. And their position
by settling without your involvement or consent.
They never brought to our attention. I don't know that this is in the record, but from my understanding, handling this case from the day that Horton filed it in the trial court, we never did discovery to find out what happened with that letter they sent, but I know that there was no contact with my client to come and try to pay on the settlement with the Holmes.
If there was a demand for indemnity, and your client, as I understand, has denied coverage.
My client never was notified of the case. That's our position.
They were not.
They sent the letter to someone who was not our agent. So
okay.
My client didn't know anything about the Holmes case.
Let's assume we're talking about settlement now. Let's assume the letter did go to your client demanding coverage, and your client says, we deny coverage. Is that a denial of defense or indemnity and defense?
If I wrote the letter, I would write it to both, Your Honor.
To both?
Yes.
So once you deny coverage and facts and the underlying facts, however, show in potential indemnity liability, once you've denied coverage, don't our cases say that you have denied the right to then invoke your exclusions on that? That you, once you say it's not our coverage, then isn't the insured entitled to go ahead and settle and look to you if there is in fact coverage?
Under that scenario, I'm not sure. The facts of this case, they settled and then came back to us and sued us for breach of contract, for failing to provide a defense, or for failing to pay the settlement. And we prevailed in the trial court on summary judgment on those issues.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
Your rebuttal.
Forgive me for jumping in, but going back to the question I asked about whether or not voluntary settlements are captured by the phrase legally obligated to pay, policy also says even if it does, well, policy doesn't say even if it does, but even if it does, if there was no sort of notice or involvement by the insurer, is there any kind of duty to pay the agreed settlement?
Your Honor, I think what I'd like to stress here again is that we're not here to really fight a complete coverage battle or try this coverage lawsuit. We may go back and if this case is remanded, and we may have to deal with some coverage issues, possible exclusions, whether or not conditions were complied with. But that's a separate story for on down the line.
Those were raised in the Court of Appeals or not?
Those were not, Your Honor. What we're here to talk about today is whether or not the Court of Appeals erred in concluding that because there was no duty to defend, there automatically was no duty to indemnify, applying the Griffin Rule. And what I think needs to be stressed here is one of the reasons why we submit that that was a mistake, a misapplication of the Griffin Rule. And one of the reasons why
the appeals tried carefully to follow our opinion, citing Guide 1 and citing Resser, the San Antonio Court of Appeals opinion, which was an OPAT, and even our recent language in Pine Oak seems to be very strict about extrinsic evidence. Well, how would you thread that needle or address your position in light of our pending precedents?
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, with respect to the question of whether or not we should consider extrinsic evidence to determine the additional insured issue that my co-counsel pointed out. But again, with respect to the indemnity question, I think it's very clear that the court misapplied what this court had previously clearly stated in the Griffin case. And again, I think that arises out of some black letter law that the duty to defend is broader than the duty to pay. And in many cases, that's correct, but it's not automatically true across the board. This court has told us on numerous occasions that the duties to defend and the duty to indemnify are separate and distinct. One is measured by the pleadings, the duty to defend, and one is measured by the actual facts, the duty to indemnify. So you can have situations, and I sometimes like to think about it schematically with a large circle that encompasses the duty to defend, and in some cases there can be a smaller circle within that that has the duty to indemnify. But because those two duties are separate and distinct, that doesn't hold true across the board. And that's the mistake that the Court of Appeals made here in applying Griffin.
So because there's an obligation to indemnify, even if there may not have been initially a duty, an obligation to defend, you would want us, what, to reverse the Court of Appeals judgment and have them consider those exclusion issues as it pertains to the duty to indemnify, or what?
Yes, you're correct, Your Honor. We would like for you to overrule the court's granting of summary judgment, not only with respect to the duty to defend, and I'll address that in a second, but more importantly, with respect to the point on the duty to indemnify, we need to be able to go back and have that evidence that we had submitted properly considered on the duty to indemnify.
Counsel says the trial court considered it, overruled all the objections, and ruled.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully submit that overruling objections to summary judgment evidence is not tantamount to actually considering that evidence for the duty to indemnify. We really don't know. I'm sure we got a one-liner from the trial court saying that we're going to grant your summary judgment on duty to defend and indemnity. We really don't know whether and to what extent that trial court relied on the extrinsic evidence to come up with that holding. And then secondly, most of
in light of the recent court's decision requiring the trial court to give reasons for its decisions, could this case be sent back just on that alone?
Well, I believe that you probably could send the case back, but again, I think that may be the right result here because it would give us an opportunity to go back and have that court and stress to that court that they need to be able to consider the extrinsic evidence and again stress to them that simply because you may have concluded, albeit we argue incorrectly, that there wasn't a duty to defend, you can't then automatically under these circumstances determine that there wasn't a duty to indemnify. Again, that works in most cases.
Presuming that the duties are different, I'm a little bit hung up on the legally obligated to pay point. Is there agreement among the parties that if there's a settlement, that then there's a legal obligation to pay? I thought that was disputed.
I'll probably side with, I think, the viewpoints of the other folks that have been up here talking before me and say that the policy language is pretty clear and legally obligated to pay, that would apply not only to judgments and settlements.
But is there a consent to settlement clause in the policy?
Yes, ma'am, there is.
And if there's no consent to settlement, then there's no legal obligation. Would that be correct?
Well, that's a condition. Okay, and what you're talking about, the language that we're talking about is up in the insuring agreement of the policy that really sets forth the two primary duties that we're here to talk about today, the duty to defend and the duty to indemnify. And quite frankly, I think some of the confusion may be created. I think we've given you excerpts from the standard policy that the very first line, the very first requirement on the insurance policy is the duty to pay. And then comes a sentence about duty to defend. But in practice, as we know, we're confronted with the inverse. We're confronted with the duty to defend and ascertain, you know, whether or not that's proper, and then we work on the duty to indemnify on the back end. But it's very clear from the policy itself that those two duties flow from the insuring agreement, and that the consent provision that you were talking about is a condition, much like an exclusion that you would find later in the policy. And again, I think the important thing to stress here is that we're not here to fight the entire coverage battle. What we're here is to ask this court to overrule the summary judgment that was handed down by the appellate court.
The insurer says it was never advised of the settlement until after the fact. You agree?
I believe that that's probably correct, Your Honor. But again, 16 days after this case was filed, we made demand upon that insurer for defense and indemnity.
They denied that.
So we were left on our own. We were left out in the cold by the insurance company to go ahead and defend the case as we saw fit. For reasons that are outlined in our pleadings, they're really for us to bring in Mr. Ramirez or even reference Mr. Ramirez in the pleading. We don't. There's no subcontractor defense that would be available to us. And again, we can't rely on the pleadings of the plaintiff typically in these kinds of situations to invoke a duty to defend because they simply have no reason to. They have D.R. Horton on the hook as a general contractor. So,
one question. Did you notify the company or did you notify somebody, some other person that does not function as an agent of the insurance company?
Your Honor, to be honest, I do not know the answer to that question.
It's in the record, though, somewhere?
Yes, I believe it would be.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor. The cause is submitted, and the court will take another brief recess.
All rise.